You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right On Radio, Josh talks with Michael Amram about his new book, Vote for America, A Common Guide to Electorates. Vote for America explores the electoral process, its past, present, and future. It questions why America is so much of an aspirant to immigrants, selling itself as the land of opportunity, when in truth that opportunity is out of reach to many in a limited democracy.
In the last part of the hour, I, Annie Harview, talk with Carolyn Holbrook, a writer, educator, and longtime advocate for the healing power of the arts. She is the author of an essay collection, Tell Me Your Names and I Will Testify. She is the recipient of 3 Minnesota State Arts Board grants, a 50 over 50 award, and she was the first person of color to win the Minnesota Book Awards K. Sexton Award. In addition to writing, she's a founder and director of More Than a Single Story. She teaches creative writing at Hamline University, the Loft Literary Center, and other community venues. At Hamline, she won the Exemplary Teacher Award in 2014. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Okay, I am here with Michael Amram talking about his book, Vote for America. Amram's writing with Calumet began in 2017 and has been political in nature. Prior to publishing with them, he published several books in genres that range from poetry to short stories to historical fiction. In 2015, he was asked to read his poetry at the Loft's dedication as an international peace site. Amram's first book with Calumet, 10 Years and Change, A Liberal Boyhood in Minnesota, was entered as a nominee for the Minnesota Book Award. Michael Amram, thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you.
So, you say in the book you had foreseen a future in which real democracy could take root and discuss the peril of youth where idealism can stand in the stead of pragmatism. Does America deserve our unbiased vote?
Yeah, it does. When I wrote that, I was getting to my basis, what I grew up with. I grew up at a time, you know, which is all explained in the book, 10 Years and Change, in a very political family. And, you know, at the time there were issues very similar to what's going on now, although I think there was, you know, a little more hope back then. I mean, at least from what I saw at my young age, you know, democracy could take root. You know, it was, you know, undergoing its first, shall I say, revolution. You know, since then, it's been through the mill. It's gotten better. It's worse, better and worse. And now it's at its worst. It's grown, and it really has nowhere to go. It can't, I mean, it really can't get any worse than this, especially after what Trump said about, you know, basically stealing the election. I mean, that is our democracy. And without that, pretty much game over.
There's a statistic in your book. You talk about the voting age population has not participated at optimal capacity since 1792. Do you predict 2020 will be any different?
I see it already. I've heard for example, I heard Carolina was, you know, one of the first states to start early voting, and there were like twice as many votes just that first week as there were in 2016. Something like 78,000, you know, in the state. At that point, this election will bring out scores, you know, and we'll see that VAP, that voting age population buoy like it's never been, you know, since. I iterate a lot in the book how catastrophes, war and unpopular wars and, you know, terrible presidents, it takes that for people to come out and vote. And this is, you know, you have a pandemic, a woefully inept president who is intent. I mean, I really don't see why anyone's surprised. You know, this is a man who, you know, basically lived this way all his life, you know, as being encouraged by sycophants with no accountability for his behavior. So there's no doubt that he will eventually kill us all. I'm not joking. What Republicans fail to do is see the really big picture, the long term, you know, because this guy has, you know, designs of exceeding two terms.
I recently watched a short video explaining the philosophy of Voltaire's Candide and how we should focus cultivating our own gardens instead of obsessing over problems of the public. You quote Plato in Vote for America that a penalty of not participating in politics is you end up being governed by your inferiors. What's the correct orientation, do you think? Should we have a balance of both?
Yeah. Quote I read was, what Candide is optimism. And, you know, the philosophy was, there was a political aggregate, if you keep a distance between ourselves and the outside world too close, an interest in politics or public opinion can only lead to aggravation and danger.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that. And it's funny, in chapter 5 I wrote how in the mid 40s in Chicago, there was a political aggregate, basically the Republican Party by that point was money was all they had. They needed their money. And, you know, FDR with his New Deal, this was the beginning of the power bosses. And you know the history, how that played out. You know, it grew and grew, and then you had kind of a polarization in 1968 of, how Mayor Daley ran that city, and, you know, kind of, I point out the kind of corruption within the Democratic Party. You know, explain how, you know, I thought Gene McCarthy really got railroaded at that election. So there's an aggravation, kind of a play with the word aggregate, a political aggregate. a simple part.
I wanted you to explain in more detail of the U.S. and its relationship with the Northern Triangle. Is it fair to say the United States is responsible for the mass exodus of people from El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala that are pushing towards the U.S. border?
Yes, I do believe that it is incumbent upon the United States to bear some responsibility for what's happening today, you know, for past, you know, actions in that region, you know, namely, you know, things that came out of the Reagan era, you know, and their push for that anti-communism tenor that, you know, ran through, you know, in the 50s, well into the 60s and 70s. You know, we are, America is largely a reflection of its own history, its own political missteps, you know, because presidents just aren't held accountable for their actions. You know, it's that he does not want those people, namely of color. You know, he's iterated that a number of times. You know, there's no question in my mind, there shouldn't be a question in anyone's mind that he's a seething racist who thinly veils it, you know, by saying things like, I'm the least racist person. Who else would say that? Who needs to say that? If you need to say it, it means you are.
How does the actions of one president have repercussions, possibly through multiple presidencies?
For example, I point out in the book, you know, take Roosevelt, who is, you know, completely laudable, and a lot of people hold in the highest regard, Republicans and Democrats alike, who did, you know, things that could be viewed as very racist, namely in, you know, 1939, fueled by anti-Semitism, turning a ship away of Jews, you know, and sending like 200 back to a waiting death in Germany, or incarcerating Japanese, even packing the courts to get his New Deal through. But these were all, you know, in the name of packing the courts, was in the name of something that was beneficial in the end to a lot of American workers. You know, and all these presidents who did bad things, you know, did a lot of good to back them up. Trump, on the other hand, is done nothing for maybe for a small sector, but, you know, not for the American people as a president should. He's not, you know, the president of a part of the United States. He's a part president of the United States as a whole. So, I mean, he's juvenile in this way. Like, he mimics behavior he's seen. Like, a lot of his actions, I say, well, yeah, he got that from so-and-so's playbook. He's taken a lot of cues from Nixon. You know, Nixon, who was bad for his time, you know, and we thought nothing could be as corrupt as Watergate, but, you know, and we've seen, boy, were we wrong.
Do you think it's time for us to throw out the Electoral College?
The Electoral College is, I don't see it ever going away. I think that's a conclusion I come to in the book. It's certainly Trump's bread and butter. You know, without it, he'd have never been president. Without it, Bush wouldn't have been president. It's why we have a limited democracy. It's it can be looked at in all the ways I enumerated in the book. It's beneficial even today to states like Montana, Wyoming, small population, small electoral vote counts, but it's a safety net, as I say. It's a last effort for the vote to be influenced by a partisan majority. They fear having a direct election, in general election anyways. You know, the primary, every other election is the way it should be.
American politics, you say, is a victim of its own system, where it's unwilling to allow third parties a serious platform in this country. What did you mean by that?
It's a victim of its own system because it's limited because of the two-party system, how it, I mean, there were, in the beginning, there was a Federalist Party, and the Democratic Republican Party, and then you had parties like, the Whigs and the Know-Nothings, all these other offshoots. You see Green Party, Libertarian today, Populist, basically a party for everything. And a few of these, every once in a while you'll see them gain some notoriety, even get on the ballot in some states. Federally, they have never won. In Minnesota, in like I think it was 93, Jesse Ventura was governor from the Reform Party. The way it's evolved, we're basically trapped in the two-party dynamic, and that makes us a victim of our own system.
You share in the book, a family of Republican lawyers who have voted for Trump, and you have a whiff of doubt they will again. Do you predict there will be a change of heart by many well-intentioned Republicans with similar backgrounds this upcoming election?
Okay, here's the way I look at it. A lot of people have probably already voted, but I think that it's gonna come down to them saving face. None of those Republicans in this family who I was talking about, educated and down earth, they hadn't anyone who has drank the Kool-Aid, and for whatever reason, they're like trapped in this nonsensical world, this immoral world, Luciferian. It's like the battle between good and evil. And, you know, I guess I see it like, you know, a lot of those people who voted for Trump in 2016 are said to have held their nose and voted for Trump. I think those people, that family of Republicans, when it comes down to it, will hold their nose and vote for Biden.
There are calls to lower the voting age to 16 because of gun violence. What benefits or drawbacks do you see if this was enacted?
Gun violence. You know, I see the violence stopping. We wouldn't lead the world in gun deaths. The flip side is there'd be a lot of backlash from these, you know, Second Amendment groups that, you know, are scared to death that right's gonna be taken away. That right, that simple basic right that they have perverted, beyond recognition. I recently read that the boyfriend of Breonna Taylor was, by the very definition of that right, kept a gun to defend himself against intruders. Although that right, I guess, does not apply to people of color. You know, so there's kind of a double standard there. People of color can't defend themselves. Rights, put it simply, don't apply to everyone, and that's one of the problems.
Lyndon Johnson was contemplative after signing the Civil Rights Act in 1964. He was quoted as saying afterwards that he thought they just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come. After George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Trayvon Martin, reaction we've seen on a global scale, do you think 2021 will be that time starting to end?
Well, I certainly hope so. This is a step in the right direction. Although sometimes I question the sense of, protesting to these years, to this administration, of all people. I mean, if it wasn't heard before, it's certainly not going to be heard by this. And as you can see, it's aggravating the situation. Might even be counterproductive, but I definitely see the frustration, the anger, George Floyd, that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, and now Trump is conflating this with these Antifa thugs, and blaming people who are merely exercising their First Amendment right, as they've been doing for decades. So I mean, that's what he's counting on. He wants that. I guess I just wonder what would happen if no one came out one night, secret police suddenly found no one to tear gas. I think we'd take a big lever away from Trump.
You relay a story that Oprah Winfrey shared of an uneducated sharecropper in 1946 named Otis Moss, who walked a total of 18 miles after being directed to different polling stations at each stop. How come it took over four decades and two generations of idealism to find that peak again, that motivation to want to try to vote?
I point out, the suppression, the invalidation, the different steps it takes, the trivial things like not having a hyphen correctly placed can invalidate a ballot or a registration form. All this works, especially in college students, like I explain in the book, to create a sense of apathy, like, why vote? And that, that leads to just people taking it for granted that they can always vote. And that they will if it gets bad enough. I think anyone could decipher that democracy is predicated on the idea that everyone will vote, everyone will participate. And that story of Otis Moss, Oprah told that, to illustrate like how valuable this was, especially to people of color, what they went through to be able to vote, what women went through to be able to vote. Like I mentioned in the book how, so far in my life, how easy it has been for me to vote. And until this election, like, I have my mail-in ballot, but I've heard conflicting stories. Like, someone told me mail-in votes are just invalidated, just like that. Blanketly, this is true. I mean, we're sunk. Biden does not have a chance. I think at this early date, I'll send in my ballot, take my chances.
My last question for you: Lyndon Johnson was also quoted as saying, "The vote is the most powerful instrument devised by man for breaking down injustice." Does this instrument hold the same power?
Yes and no. Like I said, voting has been minimized through history. How loudly it speaks, how hard it is, how vigilant Republican administrations are suppressing in their motives for doing so. In this case, it's unprecedented. No one has ever fixed an election to this extent. Because let's be honest, Trump is terrified of not winning, because it will mean he is very likely to be held accountable and will be prosecuted for everything. And I hope to God that he is, you know, but I don't know what the rules are, but it can be easily proven that he won the election by illicit means, you know. In that case, I don't see why someone's not disqualified or at least strip an athlete of his medals if they drugs or steroids.
You're listening to me talk with Michael Amram about his new book, Vote for America, published by Calumet Editions. Mr. Amram, thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, thanks for the time.
And now this.
I'm Annie Harview, and you are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM, streaming live on the web at kfai.org. Hi, Carolyn. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Oh, great. Perfect. Awesome. It's such a pleasure to have you on air. I really loved your collection. Could you start us off, just dive us right into the story by reading out loud a passage?
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thanks for having me, by the way. I definitely have the young parents' attention now. Questions flowed one after the other, most centering on why I had stayed in an abusive relationship for so long, how I dug myself out of poverty, and how I got where I am now in this classroom with them. I answered all of their questions candidly and was especially thrilled to tell them about Miss Johnson, my eighth grade English teacher. She played a major role in my eventual return to education. Miss Johnson had somehow made me feel like she saw more in me than just a girl who so often gave teachers good reasons to send her to the principal's office or to simply ignore me, making me feel invisible. She always had a smile for me when I entered her classroom, and she enjoyed the poems I wrote in her class. And even though there are a lot of well-educated people in my family, she was the first person to make me feel like I might someday be college material myself. Her belief in me stayed in the back of my mind throughout my years of struggle. She is the reason why today I look for the light in the students I work with at the private college and the community college where I have taught. Because of Miss Johnson, I know how important it is to focus on that light, even though it may be shining dimly when students first enter my classroom. I know firsthand that a spark I light may someday catch fire. And I also know that, like Miss Johnson, I may not be the one to witness the flames that I may have ignited.
Thank you so much. I really love that passage. It brings up a lot of the themes coursing through the book that I especially appreciate about seeing the good and the uniqueness in humanity. Speaking of the way that courses through various essays, the essays in this collection aren't strictly in chronological order, at least in terms of the events they describe, but they unfolded in a way that introduced and expanded on ideas and interpersonal relationships and themes, but also with essay collection variety. How did you go about creating an order for the essays in this collection, especially since some had been previously published, and was it a challenging task?
Well, I'll give a lot of credit to my editor. I had a wonderful editor at University of Minnesota Press. He helped me arrange the book because, as you pointed out, some of the essays were written some time ago, and I wasn't quite sure, you know, how they should be ordered. Mm-hmm. And he ultimately helped me put it into some sort of logical order. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, it didn't need to be chronological. It was more based on theme than chronology. Mm-hmm. So, I needed an objective person to help me figure that out. Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful. That's so great that you were able to have that positive relationship with your editor. Mm-hmm. Another theme in this collection that I think was treated really well is shame, especially shame brought about in society in its many nefarious shapes. Even in this book, so many types of shaming that stem from anti-Black prejudice, racism or classism. Just within this collection, for those who haven't finished it or haven't read it yet, there are such powerful real-world examples of shame people are forced to feel surrounding everything from teen pregnancy to incarceration, to being a victim of abuse, to feeding your kids on food stamps. Do you, Carolyn, see writing as a tool for overcoming shame? And if so, how do you see that play out in your own work?
That's a wonderful question.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a great question. Creativity definitely helps work through shame. I still struggle with shame and guilt. And I just think it's part and parcel of living a life in a culture that values something different from who I am. My life has had many, many twists and turns. It has not gone from one trajectory to another. And, you know, what I learned is that my journal listened to me when no one else would. And, I've also just have a really strong belief in the healing power of creativity and of telling your story. And so, yes, very much the creative process helped me through shame and continues to help me through those monsters called shame and guilt. Yeah.
Something I really loved, as you mentioned journaling, something I really loved in this collection is the way you pointed out and were honest about seeing cycles in your journal, seeing cycles of different feelings or struggles. I think it's really powerful that you compiled things long enough, and it's clear that that has done good for your writing in more of a career sense. Another part of the richness of these essays is the way you're able to admit your mistakes, like staying at toxic or racist jobs for too long or taking the wrong approach for the first part of a teaching opportunity. And then you're able to flip that and laugh at yourself, like the chapter where you describe your children evaluating your dates. How does it feel to include all these different facets of yourself in writing that becomes public?
Well, right now it's feeling pretty good. it took me a long time to decide whether, you know, which essays to publish. Some of them have been published in other publications, and others, you know, I waited until this book. But yeah, it's always been an important part of my life to be honest with myself and to laugh at myself, because, you know, through struggles with depression and other forms of mental illness, having a sense of humor is a saving grace, along with exercise and whatever else you need. Mm-hmm. So, and it's always been important for me that my kids be able to talk to me about whatever they want to talk to me about. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that I was able to, you know, create that kind of relationship with my children, because I did not have that with my parents.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, and I think a lot of people still, you know, they struggle with having, you know, honest relationships with their parents. So it's been really hard. It's been really important for me today, and as long as I've been a mom, to have that with the kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To hearken kind of all the way back to the passage you read at the beginning, in which you discussed teaching for teen parents and teaching writing skills in particular, and allowing vulnerability and honesty to kind of open the floodgates. Something that you prominently demonstrate in your teaching experiences throughout this collection that I really liked was the importance of meeting people, particularly young people, where they are, and really seeing them and acknowledging the good in them. This isn't exactly about writing, but if you have advice for listeners, just while thinking about that, which is demonstrated in so many beautiful ways in your books, how would you recommend that folks begin to build that skill in their own lives, to take people who might be in a different age demographic than them, really where they are, and just sit with them and listen with them?
Okay, I really love your questions. My goodness. yeah, I mean, this can be true of teaching, and also just of meeting people who are different from yourself in whatever environment. Mm-hmm. To to just be really cognizant of who they are, and that they are different from you. And that doesn't mean that they're bad or wrong or something like that. But, you know, something I've learned since we've been wearing masks is to know, yeah, yours is really cool, is to really pay attention to people's eyes. People smile all over their faces, you know, and it's just more recognizable now, since we can't see the mouth with these masks. I'm very much aware of how people are coming, you know, to meet me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I think that one of the most important ways to relate to people, whether they're students or whatever, mm-hmm. are to just be very much aware of who they are. Hear them when they speak to you.
Yeah.
What are they saying? Because a student knows when they walk into a classroom within the first 5 minutes, whether you like them or not. They know, and they can tell whether you are going to treat them fairly or not. And just, you know, again, Miss Johnson, my eighth grade English teacher, set that example for me by treating me like, you know, I wasn't, to her, I wasn't just that bad kid that needed to be sent to the office. She saw, you know, behind that bravado that I tried to, so hard to, you know, to play up. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that the listening, the body listening, as well as the vocal listening is demonstrated really well in your work in terms of your ability to kind of read the room in a classroom or another environment. The way you write that is really, really wonderful and really present. Essay, The Award, the way you found yourself in a depressive period, as you kind of mentioned moments ago, you found yourself in a depressive period and used a kind of a methodical structure of writing, walking outdoors just in your neighborhood, and as you said, taking it one day at a time. I found it very inspirational as someone who experiences depression. Do you have advice for any listeners who want to add creativity in their lives while also experiencing mental illness that can make their daily reality challenging?
Yeah. I absolutely believe that people who are struggling may have more creativity than people who are not. And I think it's important for us to tap into that creativity mm-hmm. in whatever way that works for us. You may enjoy cooking and creating, you know, feeding people might in really creative ways, where someone else might, you know, find writing their creative outlet, someone else music, someone else just finding different places to walk. It's just really, I think, really important to recognize that that, you know, no matter who says to you that creativity is unproductive, that you need to find a real job or some garbage like that, is just not healthy. Don't listen to them, because in your own gut, in your own being, you know who you are, and you know your own creativity. You know what lights you up. Go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought it was really powerful in the book when you discussed one of your daughters, forgive me, I can't remember which, who was getting bad grades, but you didn't interpret that as, oh, she isn't intelligent. You just saw something wrong in the environment or the way she was being pressed. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, seeing that in others, seeing that in yourself, and incorporating it into your life. Another big reason I tore through this book is because of your writing style itself. It is both smooth and straightforward enough to not bog the reader down in excess detail or lengthy metaphors, but it also evokes place and emotion in a way that transports the experience well into the mind of the reader. Do you feel that your style has evolved a lot over your life? Like, do you feel like you are close to where you started? And if you've made changes, do you feel it was deliberate or like kind of you go through a lot of classes and writing groups in the book? But do you feel it was a deliberate change, whether taught or chosen?
I think it evolved over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, most of the stories in the book went through multiple drafts.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of them some of the ones that I consider the more difficult ones to tell, went through 13, 14, 15 different drafts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we decided which ones were going to go into the book, some of them are pretty old. Mm-hmm. So I had to take a second look at, you know, how do I see this issue now, mm-hmm. as opposed to how I saw it then?
Yeah.
And then, you know, just the smoothness of the writing that you so wonderfully speak of. Thank you so much for that. It's a wonderful compliment. Didn't just happen overnight. You know, lots of practice, lots of thought, lots of, you know, getting frustrated, throwing it away, picking it back up sometimes 5, 6, 7 years later and seeing what I missed before, mm-hmm. with a new lens and also a little bit more experience as a writer. So yeah. we really need to be patient with ourselves in developing whatever we write. What do you write, Annie?
You caught me. I write short fiction and short comics. I'd like to pull out and do a graphic novel phase at some point, but I do write short fiction and short comics, and then I'll occasionally write book reviews, mostly because I like to be excited about books in a public forum with others.
It really comes through in your questions that you are excited about what you read.
I think in particularly as exemplified well in your memoir style, I feel like many memoirs are very present in the moment and go through conveying all of the weight and the emotion of physically being there. But then on the other end, there also is a tradition of memoirs with a lot of kind of retrospection and introspection that comes over time. And something exciting about this book, I felt, is that it's able to incorporate parts of each. It really felt like you'd experienced these events in different phases of your life, both in mm-hmm. living them, experiencing consequences of them, and then later getting to have that introspection, getting to find those perhaps conclusions that you wouldn't have had while you were still experiencing the emotions of just being there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's absolutely accurate.
As someone who lives and works in the Twin Cities, and for anyone who's listening in the Twin Cities, I know people listen online also, but there is a full Rolodex of Twin Cities literary organizations, past and present, some founded by Carolyn, some co-founded by Carolyn, it's clear that you've had a lot of experience finding what makes a writing group tick, what makes a writing group work for different people's needs. So for those at home who may be thinking, how can I pursue my writing over time? Your experiences in this book provide a good model of creating paths to community and excellence where they weren't before. You've created writing groups in your area. Something I love in this book is, for those who haven't finished or haven't read it yet, Carolyn literally asks for a job she wants and gets it. she asks for a job at a university and gets it. So that's pretty cool. if a listener wanted to find or create a community or mentorship in the arts, but didn't know where to start, what would you recommend just for folks at home?
Well, like you said, there's a whole Rolodex of arts organizations here in the Twin Cities, but many people don't live in the Twin Cities and things aren't as accessible to them as they weren't accessible to me when I first started. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm just kind of a bold person, I guess, and in my own quiet, introverted way. I knew what I needed, so I just went out and started it. And, you know, one of my sons once told me that, you know, he thought that I was, you know, seeking fame and fortune or something like that. And, you know, what I was really looking for was support and what I could, you know, needing what I needed as a writer. I had no idea that other people needed what I needed too. So it's like, you know, my response to him was, you know, I needed to find a way to, you know, take writing classes. So I created some. And then I turned around and saw there are a lot of people following me, which I did not expect.
Yeah.
So, you know, do again, I know some people who are more practical than I would disagree with this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Follow your heart, because it doesn't lead you in the wrong place, you know, when you are, you know, looking for a way to exercise your creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, again, somebody, you know, a lot of people may not agree with that, but it works for me. It's what I have to do.
Your son's comment is interesting, because I feel like it kind of points out the difference between writing or art as a commodity and writing or art as a psychological process. Like mm-hmm. the feeling of writing out an idea and trying to pick mm-hmm. out like themes or memories or important notes or drawing versus writing to create a final product, whether you gift it or sell it or anything else.
Yeah.
And I think that though this book is a great commodity, I enjoy owning it. I think that it's also a really wonderful testament to what can come of deciding to infuse a writing practice and a writing community in your life. And we have to wrap up right about now, but it's been so fun and delightful to have you on the show. And I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much,
Annie. Thanks again for inviting me. Bye-bye. Yeah. I'm left-handed too.
Hey.
All right. Bye-bye.
Later, bye. Listening to Write On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org.
I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Michael Amram and Carolyn Holbrook, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Write On Radio at kfai.org/program/writeonradio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast, found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere else podcasts can be found. Now, stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.